Hello, I'm Paul Barclay with you tonight on RN and via the web at abc.net.au, or you might be listening via our podcast. You're with Big Ideas. Thanks for tuning in for our last week of regular programs for the year. Next week, we kick off our summer series. The Christmas holidays are, as you know, virtually upon us, meaning media attention will soon focus, as it does every year, on the number of Australians killed on the nation's roads. It's an annual ritual, with the news media, especially TV, warning us of the police blitz on the roads, reporting on the rising tally of fatalities, and of course, presenting us with graphic images of the aftermath of car crashes. But how constructive or informative is this type of media coverage? Does it help improve road safety? Or does it focus too much on blame, on victims, and not enough on causes and preventative measures? Last year, around 1,300 Australians died as a result of road collisions. A sobering number, but if you include the number seriously injured, that figure climbs to well over 30,000 Australians. That's year in, year out. And you might be surprised that alcohol and speed is the cause of fewer than half of all road deaths. So, how do you reduce road carnage and how can the media help? Tonight we're bringing you a forum recorded at the recent Australasian College of Road Safety Conference. Let's head to the venue, the National Wine Centre in Adelaide. Yours truly is the host, and our panel consists of Lachlan McIntosh, the President of the Australasian College of Road Safety and Chair of the Australasian New Car Assessment Program, Paul Bongiorno, the National Affairs Editor of Network 10 and Canberra Press Gallery member, Dr. Paul Willis, Director of the Royal Institution of Australia, an independent not-for-profit organisation promoting public awareness and understanding of science, and Ian Johnson, Adjunct Professor at the Monash University Accident Research Centre, who gets things started by explaining how the media tends to report road safety.
The way road crashes are covered is all about blaming the victim. It's a dramatic crash. It's a crash in which someone has clearly done something wrong. The reality is that in any system where the human is the only active element, if you investigate a crash, you're going to have to find some piece of behaviour somewhere in the end. And we call it following too closely or inattention, all of which implies some kind of reprehensible behaviour, not necessarily a simple mistake. So, yeah, and cause does not equal cure either. There are lots of things we can and should be doing other than just changing behaviour. Having said that, our behavioural measures have been extremely successful. But we've pretty well got to the bottom of the barrel, and if we want to go much further, we've got to do some other things as well.
Well, I was interested to find out under half of fatal crashes are caused by the types of behaviour that we harp on about all of the time, speed and alcohol. 10% of non-fatal crashes are caused by illegal behaviour. That's a very different picture from the picture that gets painted in the media when they talk about these issues.
Well, that's research coming out of CASA from University of Adelaide here that's looked at fatal crashes and non-fatal crashes, urban and rural, and taken apart what's gone on, tried to see what proportion of illegal, negligent behaviour is there. And it really, in fatals, sure, it's much higher, but it's still, I don't think it's quite half. Jeremy can probably help me there, but I think it's just under half. And with non-fatal crashes, it's about 10%. So they're what covered in the media are the illegal things, and what really happens out there is much more the product of not infallible human beings going around their normal daily business.
Yes, a system's fault, I understand, is what it's called. Lachlan, we use that term system's fault. What are we talking about? What are some of the broader causes, if you like, of road crashes that we're not as familiar with in terms of the media coverage anyway?
Well, you're right. It is this. It's a hard thing to get your head around, systems, because we're always looking for a one-off solution. We look for, you know, the silver bullet or one activity. And in so many areas of what we do, things are a mixture of things. The road, the car, the driver, the weather, You know, it's fascinating when you think about the road. We have this speed limit on the road, and we say that's the limit and we must drive to it at some sort of target. Whether it's rainy, windy, busy or whatever, we have a view that we should do that. Why would we do that? We don't do that anywhere else. We set limits for trains that vary at different levels, and that's okay. An aircraft travels at different speeds depending on certain things, but somehow or other we have a view that the speed limit is fixed. And it's not. It depends on the road itself, depends on what the markings on the road are. There's a whole raft of things. I mean, just sitting here is interesting, thinking about all the diversity of the people that are in this room. Women, men, suits, younger people even, you know. It's instead of just us old people up here. But I think there's a huge diversity, cultural diversity, and so we have to somehow we expect you all to behave exactly on the same on the road. Well, the chance of doing that's about zero. But the chance of getting you into a road that has the same consistency is a bit different. Why don't we have a consistency in road marking across the country? Why don't we have a consistency in the infrastructure in which you drive? You would then think when you drive, well, this is about a 50-kilometre-an-hour road. This is about a 100-kilometre-an-hour road. But we don't have that. Because we've grown up driving, we've grown up with this thing, and we've grown up with a very, perhaps a Eurocentric view of driving as well. There's a whole raft of other people from other countries coming here who don't have that experience.
In other words, these things contribute a lot more to road crashes than we would otherwise believe.
Absolutely, and the cars are so different. The changes are so different. I think that's the other thing. We all grew up when we were talking this morning about the first seatbelts in the cars, when we actually drilled holes in the side of the door pillars to put the seatbelts in. You know? I mean, today, your car comes with not only with the seatbelt, but we had one manufacturer showing me on Monday this week a whole new seatbelt that's much more comfortable, changes the way we would sit and therefore more acceptance. The whole new radars that are in the car. The minister spoke this morning about the smart technology and the infrastructure. But we still live in the area we grew up in, driving hard, you know, making sure you can accelerate out of a problem and all these sorts of things. So we need to get ourselves up to date. Mm. I think simply we need to tell more people about your solutions. And there are lots and lots of solutions. And the sooner we get out there and say, hey, we can make a difference, we will.
I'm just remembering my first car, which was an EH Holden, that needed to have seat belts installed in it. They needed to be retrofitted by doing exactly as you said, drilling a hole through the pillar. But the back seat didn't need to have the seat belts put in.
That was right. Or it was when airbags first came in, you didn't give one to the passenger.
Yeah,
there's no point in having an airbag for your wife. What was the point, you know?
I can tell you, when I first got my licence, they should have certainly put seat belts in the back of the car.
I can remember, we talk about evidence this morning, I can remember a manufacturer saying to me when we were doing crash testing years ago that, the evidence says that you don't really need an airbag for the passenger because they don't have a steering wheel in front of them. So it's much safer that way. Mm. I said, tell my wife. You know?
Yeah.
I think that the reality is no one would think that you don't have two airbags in the car today in the front and you don't have seat belts in the back.
Paul Bongiorno, what are the news values that come into play when we report road crashes on TV? It's about pictures and it's about drama, really, isn't it?
Well, that's certainly the case. And it's more to the point, it's about what affects people. So when you do a news report, and I think maybe at the outset we should make a few distinctions here. When we say the media, I guess we mean the mainstream media. When we say television media, well, I work in television. I predominantly work in television news. But there's also television current affairs and there's also television drama. And when we're talking in this issue, if you watch commercial television, I hope you all do all the time, you'll see the commercials, either put on by state governments or safety organisations. That's all the media doing its job. But coming back to the news, television news, which I've been in now for 38 years, and I've worked both at capital city level and in regional level, often from a TV news point of view, depending on the time of the year and what else is around, a road crash is the story of the day. And we're grateful for it from that point of view. And, of course, the more dramatic the road crash, the more tragic the road crash, the greater the news value, because people will be interested, people might identify with it, and it may well stir controversy. So depending on where you are, it may stir the the local police to say something, or it may get the Premier of the state involved if issues are raised in some particular way because of this accident.
And there's a victim, there's often a guilty party,
yep.
And fault usually plays a pretty strong part in the story.
Yeah, that's interesting, because as young journalists, you're cautioned and you're trained to report crashes in such a way, well, they're accidents really, and vehicles hit each other, and you're warned not to ascribe you as the journalist fault, although it's pretty hard to say, to avoid saying, well, the truck hit the car. Maybe it's for the coroner to work out why, but that which goes to the point that was being made before.
Yeah. Paul Willis, what observations would you make about the way, and we are talking here about, I suppose, at the moment anyway, television news and current affairs and also perhaps newspapers, the way they cover road crashes. What's the sort of narrative that they generally construct with these stories?
Yeah, I think we need to take a step back and actually ask, what are we as a community interested in road safety messages? What are we expecting of the media? And then ask, well, what does the media in its different forms actually do? And so how do we bring those two together?
Mm.
You know, all media is about entertainment. That is the primary thing. You entertain by telling stories. So you need those elements in order to move forward. News, you need to have something new to put in there. So a new story that's entertaining. You know, that's the reason why the crash will make it onto the evening news. But if what you want to do is establish a discussion, an ongoing issue, then the place to do it is not in the news bulletins. Mm. To some extent, you can carry that over into current affairs programs. But something that's missing in the whole picture at the moment, as far as I'm concerned, is where is the coverage of car accident victims and road safety issues on Australian Story or in Neighbours or in Home and Away? How often do we actually see those discussions carried on as elements in the plot of TV drama? That's the way to maintain the discussion. The news is a good way to start the discussion, but I think we need to look across the media, particularly the traditional media of television, newspapers and radio, on a more holistic basis, rather than just sort of say, well, what can we do in the news?
And you'd have more of a chance through the vehicle of drama and through the storytelling of Australian Story to perhaps flesh out some of the issues rather than just the shock horror pictures.
Well, exactly. I mean, imagine the impact that you would have if, for example, on Neighbours, someone is involved in a serious car accident, and over the course of 6 months' worth of episodes, we see them going in and out of hospital and in rehab and what have you. You know, that's a far more realistic way and far more confronting way to discuss the back issues that aren't newsworthy, that you can't actually maintain a discussion in the news bulletins, but you could do that theoretically in drama. You know, it's a model that was based on The Archers in England, which is a long-running radio show which was set up after the Second World War. It's about life in an English farm. The reason that program was put together and the reason why it's still on air today is to teach people how to be farmers, because most farmers were shot during the Second World War and they needed to re-establish agriculture in England. Mm. So you tune in today and you'll be sitting there saying, oh, are you seeing the new EU rules on silage? I'm wondering how I'm going to get around them, you know. And they maintain a discussion through drama.
Yeah.
And I think we could do a lot more in that department.
Ian, you're frustrated, I know, by the way television and the media generally, and as we've already heard, the media is a catch-all term. There is no one media. But you're frustrated by the prominence that spectacular, dramatic road crashes get, to the detriment, really, of the presentation of the overall picture?
Well, yeah, I'm frustrated, but then I'm old and, you know, you get... Anyway, that's beside the point, I guess. It really... It's not just about the way we deal with individual crashes. It's about the way we allow debates to unfold about some of the critical measures. Speed cameras are probably a classic. And I must admit, I learnt the power of social media when I featured in an ad put out by the TAC, which attempted to explain to people what a difference of 5 kilometres an hour made to stopping distance. And I got the most incredible volume of hate mail on that, and that got me to start looking at some of the websites where so much alleged science was taking place, and it'd be impossible for people to tell the difference between one and the other. So it's, I think, because we report the crashes in only a blame the victim sense, when it comes to discussing the issues, we carry over that mindset to the discussion of issues. And, you know, I've been in the game long enough to remember the public debate around seatbelt wearing. And there wasn't social media at the time, but there was lots of stuff about, oh, it's much better to throw yourself down on the front seat and all of that than be restrained and risk hitting the steering wheel. And the same thing with random breath testing before it came in. So don't just imagine that what's happened with speed cameras and speed management generally is a one-off. In fact, it's really instructive to look back at media discussion of issues we resolved a couple of decades ago because the debates were just as bitter and twisted as they are now.
Well, to some extent, if the media is negligent in its reporting of something like speed cameras, and I note that Media Watch did an examination of a current affairs story on this, actually. If it's the case that the media are at fault, well, perhaps it's also the case that the public has the wrong perception as well. I was going to put this to Lachlan, but perhaps you could chime in too, Ian. It seems that virtually everybody you talk to is of the belief that speed cameras exist almost entirely to raise money for government rather than improve road safety.
I'll come to the second bit, but the first bit, I don't think we should be blaming the media at all. I think we, in the professional community, are lousy communicators. You know, we haven't set about really correcting some of the misperceptions that are out there. And if the police, and bless the police, they do a fabulous job, but their role is to find out who behaved illegally, and that gets reported, and the insurance companies want to limit their liability, So everyone's looking for blame, and so we shouldn't be surprised that... And the politicians love blame the victim because it saves them having to spend money on infrastructure, and the vehicle manufacturers love it because it saves them having to do anything serious about speed control within their vehicle design. So there are lots of interested parties that perpetuate the myths that are there. So it's not about blaming the media, it's about how we can use them to get the kind of public debates we really need to get going, to get the things done that we need to get done.
Yeah, I mean, Lachlan, there does seem to have, something has gone wrong with the issue of speed cameras in the public perception, because actually they work. And there's scores of peer-reviewed studies that prove they work, yet there is this disconnect between that reality and how members of the community see them.
Yeah, I think that's right, and we all feel a bit, personally affronted if we find for some small misdemeanour that the speed camera picks up, and it's like the parking fine, you know, you're 5 minutes late, and so you have to pay the full whatever it is. So, but the reality is that the technology, if you like, in monitoring these things, and Ian says that, you know, the car manufacturers tend to sort of sell to a market who are looking for, the marginal market, who are looking for the bright coloured car that does whatever speed it's supposed to do. But the majority of people are not in that space. And I think we are seeing a shift away from that. The technology will, you're already in insurance in some parts of the world, you put your little chip in, your monitoring device in, and you get a discount on your insurance if you haven't exceeded the speed limit during or driven in some particular way. So we're sort of in a transition zone. I think the speed camera argument will fade off. We won't see that. The point-to-point speed camera in some form, the GPS in your car, will send a message back to your insurance company. If you behave badly, you'll pay more. Or, better put it the other way, I think we're all get stuck in this blame business, you'll pay less if you behave well. And I think that'll just be a normal part of what we do. We won't think twice about it. But how we report that and who reports it is really interesting. Just this week, or last week, there was in Popular Science, another unusual road safety magazine, there's an article entitled, or the editorial, in Robot We Trust. And it talks about automated cars, and he makes the point in here that by the time we have the next Senate election, there'll be a party out there objecting to automated cars because we want manual driving. And that's because a small proportion of people will want to have that view. But the large majority of people will be more than happy with automated cars. You don't expect to get in an aircraft that flies from here to Darwin non-stop and not hope it has a computer in it. I mean, what would you do if you thought the pilot had to pay attention all the time? You'd be terrified. Mm. So why do we allow a B-double truck to drive all that way without some sort of automated control? It's just crazy. So we have to take a shift in our thinking into this new space. We expect the phone to tell us where we are. I can remember we were doing surveys on GPSs years ago, and we asked people, well, what about this GPS in the car? It might sort of locate where you are. And all the men said, oh, that'd be terrible. You know, the last thing you want to know is to have a report on where we've been. And we asked the women in the group, well, you know, what do you think about that? That's fine, they said. And we thought, that's a bit odd. So we delved a bit more in the questioning, and the women said, well, if you want to hide from what you're doing, you catch a taxi. Why wouldn't you? I mean, the men weren't smart enough. So, I mean, I think, you have to sort of realise the game's shifted. Just as in other areas, in medical science, in all the computing we do, motoring is going to be so different. We've got to move there quickly.
Lachlan, to get there, even in this whole debate over the speed camera, for example, how do we make it fashionable and business sense for insurance companies to, as it were, put pressure on car manufacturers to offer this technology so that this can be achieved? Now, the whole issue of speed cameras for the media, two stories that we love reporting is when the speed cameras are found to all be wrong and state governments have to pay back hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, that's a terrific story. And the other thing is, I've noticed in recent state elections in Victoria and New South Wales that the leaders of the opposition won kudos by promising never to use their speed cameras to collect revenue. And people said, yeah, what about that? And then, of course, there is an issue here because, I mean, our politicians are leaders of our community and it's them that we need to implement things in a broader scale. It's clear that even though we believe that the speed that thrills is the speed that kills, there must be some death wish in us that hillbilly politicians can even say, well, we're going to take a speed limit off. And I'm sure if the premier of this state or other state said, well, we'll do it for 200 kilometres, but it'll be, up the north of the state or somewhere else, there'd probably be, sufficient support for it unless mobilised it.
There is, but if you said to the same premier, your trains will now do the same speed as the Japanese fast trains or the European Eurostar, and they'll do it on the old tracks that you've got now, people would say, I'm not getting on that train.
Yeah.
What do you think I am, stupid? Well, that's what the Northern Territory government's now saying to people. We're going to let you drive at whatever speed you like on this road that's meant for 1940s cars. I mean, what sort of lunatics are they?
That's Lachlan McIntosh. Our other guests are Paul Bongiorno, Paul Willis and Ian Johnson. You're with Big Ideas on RN and online. I'm Paul Barclay. You can podcast or stream tonight's discussion and other Big Ideas talks from our website at abc.net.au/radionational. And you can follow us on Twitter at @RNBigIdeas. Back to the conversation on road safety now. How do you ensure media reporting of this emotive and sometimes sensationalised issue is based on scientific evidence? Paul Willis.
This is where we need to introduce better utilisation of the online and new media, because the significant difference is that you control the message and you also are able to explain. Now, under the old media model, where you went to a television station, a newspaper, the radio with your story, and it got mangled and was put out in the form that the television station wanted to put out to maximise their audience, because that's what they're about, bums on seats, more advertising revenue. Under that model, your story is reduced to a couple of sound bites, and it's the sound bites that they want to make into their story, which may have nothing to do with what you want to do. Online, you control the story from beginning to end. So you can actually shape the message that you want to get out there. And also, you can explain. All too often in the old media model, you could do little more than make a slogan. Don't speed, it's dangerous. And people don't really respond very well to slogans. In fact, there's quite a reaction against them. Online, you can actually take the time and say, if you speed, this is actually what happens. This is why we're asking you not to speed. And that's a more effective way of communicating to most people, is explaining why you're asking them to do something rather than telling them to do something. So I think that, you know, we really need to move the discussion online in order to enrich the depth of it. So in the case of speed cameras, I mean, there's already the anti-speed camera lobby out there in force in the online space with their arguments. What you need is a good site that's not just a web page with all the facts and figures, but is an ongoing discussion where you can say, look, this is the paper that shows that actually no revenue was generated out of the use of speed cameras, but what actually happened was the road toll went down, or, you know, you had the reduction of speeding. And you put it there and you create a discussion. And so you can then, you just move the whole thing forward.
You have this difficulty, though, with online media, and that is there's so much information out there, it can be difficult to separate authoritative information from bogus information. How do you make sure that the website that actually has the evidence is the website that's getting read rather than that one that's screaming at people about how this is all a government conspiracy?
This is an ongoing problem that we face all the time as science communicators, is that our competition is non-science, is scientifically inaccurate information. And the real problem is it's brilliantly camouflaged online. It's very difficult to pick from the good stuff. It's usually presented on a very professionally developed website, and it has all the latest plugins and what have you, and it's got high production values. The only mechanism I can see at the moment is to establish for yourself a reputation of integrity in the information that you provide. And you do that by being selective in what it is that you actually put up, but also who you connect with. So, you know, if you are putting it up there and saying, this is scientifically accurate information on the issue of road safety, and you're linked with the Academy of Sciences or RIOS or the ABC Science Unit or whatever, that tells someone coming there, well, actually, yeah, those are institutions I respect for their scientific integrity, so I'll weight the information I'm getting through this site more appropriately.
Maybe we're reacting to, if you like, the negative. We are wasting a lot of our time. Maybe we should have other messages. Maybe there are far more things that are interesting or whatever to convince people. And I think Ian had made the point that we've got a national road safety target that says we've got to reduce deaths and injury by 40% in this decade. Well, that means that we're going to still, that means 60% of the people who are currently dying, that sort of rate, still going to happen. So a couple of 100,000 people are going to die in the next 10 or 20 years, die and be injured. Mm. And is that acceptable? Is that an acceptable to this community to say, oh, it's okay that even another 10,000 are going to die? I mean, is that okay? We never ask that question. We say, oh, we've done really well, thanks very much. And we all say, that's good, yes, we can do a little bit better. But we never go out and really draw another, and maybe we need to think differently about how we put the message out to people and say, not only that, we do know there are solutions. And reducing speed in some circumstances is worthwhile. The reality is that people are interested in a story and whatever. And if you say, well, look, if the road's okay, you can do 110. But if it's raining and it's wet and there's a lot of traffic, how stupid is it to do 110? So the speed camera should be there, or the speed camera's passé. Your GPS now tells you whether you're at the right speed or not. Your GPS can read the road sign and put it up in front of you. You know more now than you ever knew before. Now, that doesn't apply to the majority of the fleet of cars. So we've got to find a way to aftermarket fit them or do that. But let's engineer out all those people. And sure, there's going to be a people who will cheat. There'll be people at the margin who are going to sort of do that. Well, let's prosecute those. Let's get into that sort of... But don't blame the rest of society for the people at the margin. And that's the problem.
The time is right, you guys, in this particular instance, to put out a positive message and to lead the conversation, not to react. So, you know, why instead of a campaign for not creeping, was one of the recent ones here, or don't be distracted while you're driving, how about a campaign saying, we want to reduce your insurance premiums, and this is how we're going to do it? And then, you know, introduce back from that, that if we can introduce these measures, your insurance premiums are going to go down. More people are going to be surviving their trips on the road.
Positive
message. The time is right to lead rather than react.
But, I mean, that's the type of thinking that comes from somebody who's worked in the media. Isn't part of the problem, Ian, that we have some great scientists and researchers doing some amazing work demonstrating some fantastic new technologies, for example, but they're not that good at communicating the information?
Yeah, I happen to agree with that. I think as a safety community, we haven't been very good at engaging in, if you like, the popular science part of the debate. And it was really interesting listening to Paul this morning about how you need to get on the front foot. And I think we've got to do more. I agree that we can put a lot of this out in the social media. But I think the one thing we're really missing is the leadership on the big issues. No one's out there really creating a public storm, if you like, the champions. And again, if you go back into history and you think about how did seatbelt wearing become compulsory? Well, it really was because there were some leaders, particularly in the College of Surgeons, who were getting up in arms about having to patch people together, and they really, and in the old days at least, surgeons were well connected to the good schools, and the good schools had the right politicians, and so they used their networks and they got the legislation up. I mean, it's not quite as simple as that, obviously. Same with the early blood alcohol legislation. Was it really, again, about leaders becoming passionate about a particular issue and driving it? And that'll get a public debate up.
Sorry, the point about public debates from that point of view, because what you're talking about there is leaders like Dr. Birrell in Victoria, who mobilised public opinion and motivated the state government at the time to act. And those of us who can remember, and we've hinted at it today, there was opposition. Civil libertarians didn't want to wear seatbelts. Taxi drivers didn't want to wear seatbelts. All of this sort of argument did go on. And that sort of controversy can scare politicians. But probably there is an opportunity now, and I'm aware that I'm in Adelaide and we're all discussing the future of General Motors, and maybe it's time to grasp the nettle and move the whole road safety debate, not away from, because we still need to talk about the nut, you know, behind the wheel, but talk about doing more with the other nuts in the car, even though they're, what is it, 250 microchips per car these days. But to get the others that Lachlan has talked about, that just imagine if Australia had the sort of legislation that Japan has that says you can't have cars over, I think it's 4 or 5 years old, on the road. That forces people to go and buy cars, newer cars, and if you're buying newer cars, hopefully they're being made, some of them or more of them are being made locally.
Well, you could also, to some extent, Paul, have an influence on that. You could say to the car companies, we're happy to continue supporting you if you improve the safety of vehicles, if you improve perhaps even the emissions of those vehicles.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I spoke yesterday to Jamie Briggs and Kim Carr from the opposition, who just very recently has been the industry minister, and neither of them see much merit in tying government subsidies to the car makers in Australia to their performance on safety. You know, my question to them was, should Holden perhaps try to out-Volvo Volvo as a selling point? And they said no.
I think we see in Sweden where the government is unable to directly subsidise the car industry because of the European rules, but it does provide a huge amount of research, and it encourages collaborative research between a raft of other organisations, universities, suppliers, institutions, companies, and lo and behold, who is the beneficiary of that? Volvo. And so they you can go to the US and you see lots of Volvos, you don't see too many Holdens driving around. So, but I think maybe the tipping points to get some action, to get some leadership is important. The insurance one is interesting. I got a text this morning from the UK. There's a company there which does provide low-cost benefits for young people from the 18 to 25-year-old group. And now it's now about to offer another product for older people. It hasn't been doing that. There obviously become a demand. Older people suddenly realise that, hey, maybe I can get a cheaper insurance if I drive better. And so you can create that sort of demand using other people. And rather, maybe we rely too much on government and ourselves sometimes. I mean, we've seen big companies make big shifts in their attitudes to road and vehicle safety recently, where they're actually, companies are actually saying, we're losing half our workforce in the workplace crashes and accidents or events, and they're occurring on the road. So some companies are saying, we're only buying five-star cars now. Some companies are saying, we are insisting that when we upgrade a road in a particular area, it has these safety features, or it's actually a two or three or four-star road. Mm-hmm. We're actually seeing companies, big companies, set the agenda. Lots of small fleets are saying that. Charitable organisations are saying, we can't take a risk anymore to have our employees in anything less than a five-star car. And if you buy 100 cars because you're providing nursing care for some big remote and regional area, it makes a big difference. So then that sort of message gets through to people and we start to tell another story. And those things like speed limiters or whatever, the Ford MyKey system, which limits the, you can give your child, your younger driver, a key that only lets the car do 60 mile an hour where you can do 80, how good is that? But at least technology is going to change those things. So, but fixing it today is a bit tricky, but we've got to have a vision that we're going to make that shift. And if you explain that to people, you may well then convince people that today's messages aren't so bad anyway.
On that issue of leadership, though, I mean, you've just given an example of how the corporate sector is leading to some extent. What's impeding political leadership?
I think the minutiae of good... I think Paul made the point this morning, or the minister made the point this morning, actually, didn't he, about how the Greens were influenced by, some campaign on driver training that, if you get 500 Facebook hits, it must be a terrible problem. Well, we the rest of the community, have to say that's rubbish, and I think we have to support the politicians. I wonder how many people here spoke to a politician either at a state or federal level about the work you do in road safety. How do they know that there are solutions? We don't tell them. We hope they're going to read the material we send them in a letter. They get thousands of hits about other things, but the people who are concerned, who want small things done, make a lot of noise. Mm. Those of us who are nice and rational, that's us, of course, you remember, put your hands up, you're rational, we are not good at, as Ian said, putting out our message. So, but if we do that, we'll get the leadership. You'll suddenly find, if you said to Kim Carr, well, there'll be no car industry in Australia unless Holden out Volvo's Volvo, well, then we've got a purpose in life. We already do some really smart things in the supply industry in Australia. We've got some companies here that make some really smart technologies. One company just got sold to GE for $700 million and they make collision avoidance devices. They didn't get any government subsidy for that, but they had a purpose. What we need is a purpose to not have people die and be injured on the roads.
Ian?
I think there's a more powerful reason that we don't get political leadership on this issue, and that is, we've taken the behavioural control stuff, speed control, drink driving. I mean, we're still struggling with technologies like mobile phones, but we've got more legislation and regulation and enforcement supported by public education than any other Western motorised nation. And I'm not bagging that, I'm just saying it's actually been fantastic and it's taken us a long way. But we have ignored the infrastructure. And the thing, if you look at occupational health and safety, governments have happily said to corporates, you will be accountable for the level of safety within your operation. And now that we're talking about safe systems, saying the road authorities, governments generally, are responsible for designing and operating a safe system, you're suddenly saying to them, you are potentially accountable for the level of trauma that happens in this safe system that you design and operate as a public asset. And I can tell you, politicians are terrified because on the one hand they go, how much is it going to cost? And when you tell them, they really freak. So they can't find the money. And since they can't find the money, they certainly are not prepared to accept the accountability. Now, that's a real blocker. But I think there are ways in which we can, coming back to your point, Paul, about the positive side, if we were to turn the speed debate away from speed enforcement and saying, OK, you want high-speed roads, you can have them. I don't care if the speed limit's 140, providing it's a safe infrastructure for 140. Now, what does that mean? No intersections of grade, all the roadsides, all the medians are all properly protected, etc., etc. So our problem at the moment is we have a mismatch between the speed limit we apply and the level of safety built into the infrastructure.
Mm.
So yeah, we can turn the debate around, which puts the acid then on the government. And you're saying to the community, if you want a high-speed road, then you demand the level of safety that high-speed road needs.
See,
so that's a positive way of engaging the speed area.
But we also have to demonstrate that it's an investment. It's not a spend. And I think
that's
been a problem. We've said for a long time the Productivity Commission should investigate this, not ourselves, because it's a cross-the-economy issue. Mm. I mean, the reduction in health costs, the reduction in enforcement costs, the reduction in legal sort of situations that we spend our time in with arguing who's to blame. You know, if we can reduce the crashes by 30, 40, 50% by better infrastructure and better cars and whatever, we will save money. $27 billion the money we spend today, or it costs the country, but it's left to the Transport Department. The COAG ministers who meet are transport ministers. There's no interdepartmental committee in the federal government led by the Prime Minister that says this is what will make a difference. We've seen in France where the President said enough's enough when the other ministers said, how come you're so far behind?
It seems to me though, Lachlan, that the impression I'm getting now is that this is a complex story, very complex story. And if you want politicians to act, politicians will respond to their constituents. So you therefore have to make sure that the constituents know what they're talking about. For the constituents to know what they're talking about, they have to get the message across. Where do they get the message from? They get the message from the media. The media tends to work on very simple messages. Paul, you've worked as a science journalist, you're a science communicator now. How do you get across complex messages on the media? Because we're talking about a multifactorial issue when we're talking about car crashes. And what traditionally we've tried to do is to sell it as a simple issue. Don't speed, don't drink, and the road toll will plummet.
Stop the crashes, yeah.
Drive crashes. I've got an idea.
you've solved it, Paul. We can all go home now.
You've been in Canberra too long, Paul.
The problem with communicating virtually any science is that it's invisible. You know, no one can take in the enormity of the galaxy or the universe. No one has ever actually looked at an atom eyeball to eyeball. You cannot understand the complexities or take in the complexities of an ecosystem. It goes on and on and on. Science is about the unseen. Science of road safety is not much different. You know, because a lot of it is statistics, and people do not relate personally to statistics. If you want to change the dial, if you want to start a campaign to make the government do something about the condition of the infrastructure, then you would come up with what happened to shut down the livestock industry. You would come up with video evidence that you can put on four corners, and what was it, within 24 hours the whole livestock industry was shut down. Now, if there was a concerted campaign to produce that kind of footage and material in order to base that kind of campaign around, then I think it would be a no-brainer.
Yeah,
I think we'd have reaction in 24 hours.
Well, you mustn't have watched TV news for very long, because TV news is chockers. That's an old saying, is chock full of those sorts of images of car crashes and fatals and
truck crashes. But not specifically tying them to the infrastructure.
No context.
That's where people like this room is full of need to seize the opportunity.
That's what I'm saying.
And say, right here we have this situation. We saw it in New South Wales, you know, that horrific tanker crash that killed the family. That then raised the whole issue, became a broader issue of managing and policing truck safety. Also, there was an earlier truck incident on the Hume Highway, which also then raised the issue of design in a particular part of the road. And that's where safety experts have to seize the opportunity and speak out. And those issues actually can begin to run and to change people's perceptions.
And that was, you know, my case entirely. And as was said earlier, you know, that those examples that we saw, the coverage was all about finding a person to blame, a villain. Mm. So why don't we go out and get the material together that shows the wrecked car and then shows the degenerated verge that caused the car to spin off the road or whatever.
We're not activists, that's why. The people who went and saw
if you're not activists, what are you doing? You know, if you want to change the event,
Hand up all the activists here in the room, you know, who are prepared to go and do that, who are prepared to go and get onto Four Corners and say, look at this broken barrier here, this is what killed the people.
If you want to change the agenda, you're going to need activists.
Yeah, I know, but one of our real problems is that most of the road safety professionals work for government.
Yeah.
Because it's only government agencies, whether it's the road authorities or whatever, that have professional units.
Can we just do a straw poll? How many people here, as a room full of road safety experts, how many are not employed by a government?
Well, no, all researchers who depend upon... researchers who depend upon government grants.
Yeah, that's
Take
right. That's the better question. How many people here have no dependence on government funding at all?
So what's that, maybe 10%, is it?
Yeah, maybe 10%, right.
So, that's not a criticism. That's a real problem. I know when I was running the Monash University Accident Research Centre, that was a real issue. It was about wanting to be out there raising the issues and then having a sponsor ring and say, you're on pretty dangerous grounds here. Do you really want to keep your research grants? And so it becomes a very difficult thing to manage.
Mm.
So I think if we're thinking about leaders and champions, I think we have to start looking at, I don't know, national sports heroes who've somehow who are passionate about it, politicians. Hard to get them passionate about anything. I've said I'm old and... but it's the surgeons used to provide that. I mean, I think if we can't do it personally because we're afraid of the consequences, we need to start thinking about who can we, which is a different kind of communication now, who can we identify as potential leaders to stir some of these things up and provide them with the right kind of material?
What about organisations like the NRMA? Because I remember they did actually have a campaign where they were saying the cause of this accident was the state of the road.
Well, I think you have to say...
Unfortunately, that's going about two decades back.
Well, the AAA, the national body where I used to be the executive director, I'm not anymore, but, you know, we did bring out the OSRAP, the star rating of the roads, and it's now getting a bit ahead of steam. We are seeing politicians taking notice of the 2, 3 and 4 star roads, and I think the motoring clubs in the last election did force a fair bit of activity in that space, because there is a lot of information about it. It takes a while to educate us all to see that those things are possible.
You're up against the culture of the car in a society like Australia, and to many people the car equals freedom and mobility. To many people, cars reflect their own personality. People are interested in power and speed.
Some people are. Some people are interested in protection for their kids and protection for their family. There's a bigger shift now. We know from the NCAP work that more and more people are asking for a car that protects me and my family, and I'm going to buy one for my kids.
I'm sure that's
more
true.
More and more that's happening, and we're seeing the manufacturers advertising the ratings. We're seeing that shift. It's taken us 20 years to get there, but it's actually happening. But there still is, you know, a group of people who want to have a V8 Ute with, you know, flares and all the gear that goes with it. But I don't know that they are necessarily killing a lot of people anyway. I mean, but we got our messages mixed. Let's encourage those people who want a safer and better car, and we can do that. So we've got to be careful not to fall back to the old messages.
Can I, because I've seen the time, and I want to take some questions from the audience in just a tick, but can I perhaps finish, Lachlan, by getting you to describe some of the, and you've touched on them a little bit so far, some of the new technologies that are likely to make an impact in the future on road safety and that are already overseas making an impact. I mean, we've got things like smart barriers on the sides of roads, but we've also got new things on cars that are freely available on standard cars in other parts of the world that we can, I think, expect to see here in the not too distant future.
Well, I think we saw it originally with things like ABS brakes, which had some variable results, but then we moved to electronic stability control, which means that the car no longer loses traction when we used to drift. You know, that was always a big thing, that young boys could drift the car around a corner. Now, electronic stability control brings the car back, and you don't have those crashes when you lose control. The next big system is autonomous emergency braking, which relies on a radar or a video or a sonar system in the front of the car, which predicts what's happening with the car in front and will stop your car. I've got one, and I say my wife has already missed a serious crash with a motorcyclist as a result of it. That's available in cars at $15,000. It's not available in every car, and it's developing, and sometimes it's related to city speed, sometimes it's related to higher speeds. But autonomous emergency braking is a really new, looks like a very powerful technology. Lane keeping the car or the truck steady on the road. A large number of trucks are so fitted. Many cars have it. Blind spot monitoring that can pick when the car's actually on the side you can't see. There'll be a light will flash in your mirror, which shows you there's a car's there. We can even sound an audio alert. We saw a demonstration, Nick Clark and I, on Monday this week, of a device that when you actually try to swing out and there's a car in the blind spot, the car won't actually turn out or makes a bigger alert. So a brake assist is another technology, which means that people who are not very strong or lightweight, the car will recognise you're trying to brake hard and will help you make the brakes better. There's technologies to stop you, better alerts for when you're looking behind or when you're not only cameras. In fact, just recently I saw a rear vision camera, a television and a camera in a 1956 Buick Centurion. In the US, we think it's fantastic today. Well, it used to be available in 1956. You know, what's taken us so long to get these things going? So I think all these things are coming. They're coming really quickly. Some you'll be able to retrofit to your cars. The monitoring devices, I think monitoring will become more and more popular. Most big trucking companies monitor, and most mining equipment in the monitor all their trucks. They keep a record of what's happening. And once we get over the small privacy issues that someone might be watching, well, you know, who's watching what your phone's doing? No one. We've given up worrying about that. We used to worry about it. You know, they can have court cases in the UK about it, but the reality is we've got no idea and we just get over it. So the same thing will come about the driving, and the insurance will pay for that. That's happening, but we've still got to stay with, I think what Ian's made the point, we can't give up on the behavioural stuff we've done, but we can have a vision, and we should have a vision to out Volvo. Why not make Australia the leading technology place for these things? Want to have a smart Australia? Let's make some smart cars and smart technology.
Lachlan McIntosh, the President of the Australasian College of Road Safety and Chair of the Australasian New Car Assessment Program. You also heard from Paul Bongiorno, the National Affairs Editor of Network 10 and Canberra Press Gallery member, Dr. Paul Willis, Director of the Royal Institution of Australia, an independent not-for-profit organisation promoting public awareness and understanding of science, and Ian Johnson, Adjunct Professor at the Monash University Accident Research Centre. That conversation took place at the National Wine Centre in Adelaide as part of the Australasian College of Road Safety Conference. Unfortunately, no time left for questions from the audience.